All right. So, as usual, let me start by asking if you have any questions that have occurred to you about the stuff we did last class, stuff we did Monday. This is going to be my usual policy, so yes.
My question is just the purpose of game theory. I guess I still couldn't wrap my head around
yep.
all these games and you use them, but it's just its purpose.
Let me give you two different purposes. The purpose for the people who really believe in it, probably including the people who invented it, was to actually find a way of understanding and predicting the outcomes, of understanding strategic behavior, predicting the outcomes, and figuring out how you want to act. And that's a perfectly comprehensible purpose. I don't think they achieved it, but I think that was sort of an admirable goal, as it were. I sometimes describe theory of games as the most impressive failure of the 20th century. And what I use it for, the reason I think it's worth including a class, is that although it doesn't really give you clear answers, it does let you understand the problem better than you otherwise would. So that I think, to take the very simplest example, there are a lot of people who have this very strong intuition that individual rationality ought to lead to group rationality. That if you tell people the prisoner's dilemma story, many of them will react with, they've got to be making a mistake. They've got to be doing something wrong. It can't come out that way. And just realizing in this very simple toy example that it doesn't logically have to, that you can have cases where the individuals who are interacting are each of them is making the correct decision, and yet the result is a worse decision, worse result than they could otherwise. That's a useful step. But similarly, I think the whole idea of commitment strategies, that understanding what a commitment strategy is, why they make sense and such, gives you a useful intellectual tool, a useful sort of one more way of making sense of the world around you. And so does, if you take something like a Nash equilibrium, you can't say for sure that systems will always have that, but it's sort of a plausible way if you're trying to understand a bunch of people interacting and you say, you know, can I have a plausible story of what they're doing that might explain it? Nash equilibrium is one way of doing it. So I think that it's way short of a rigorous way of proving truth, but it is sometimes an informative way of looking at certain problems. Is that? Yeah. And I don't know. I guess I haven't really kept up currently. Certainly, at the point when I left Chicago about 15 years ago, there were a noticeable number of people in the law and econ world who sort of thought of game theory as the holy grail, as it were, that, you know, we can finally make this stuff rigorous. And I think that ambition has existed among economists for a long time, that, you know, here we have all this talk about what's going to happen. Can we give a mathematical proof of it? And I know, as far as I can tell, sort of as an observer, nobody's ever managed to do it. That you know, von Neumann did a lot of very brilliant work and ended up with one tiny bit of the problem solved. And other people have, I would say maybe less solved than that, but other people have shown some useful things. But that's about it. Then we sort of run through very briefly, in a sense, the stuff I've got in my notes is not that different from the answer I just gave to your question, but I'll do a quick passage to make sure I didn't miss anything. There are a bunch of different formal treatments, each of which is sort of some concept of what it means to solve a game being applied to some kinds of games. And really the first, I suppose, and the most rigorous of those probably is von Neumann's solution to the two-player fixed-sum game, and what it describes is how, in principle, each of the two players could choose a strategy where one strategy guarantees I do at least so well and the other guarantees you do no better than that, as it were. You then have Nash equilibrium, which is a way of looking at a many-player game where the players are acting independently and seeing what individual rationality corresponds to in that situation, which may or may not be group rational. And my escaping prisoner's story is a case where the individual rationality is not group rational. It'd be better if they all charged the guard, but each one of them would be worse than he did. Driving on the right, driving versus the left is another nice sort of a toy example. It's a very simple example, but it's got this feature that you've got two entirely different equilibria, each of which is stable if that's where you are. And that's an interesting concept, that sort of one of the things that people have talked about in economics for the last 20 years or so, among others, is what they refer to as path dependence, the possibility that there might be two different places your economy could end up each of which, if you got there, you'd be stable, and yet if you had only taken a different turn back here, you would have been here instead. And that's an interesting idea, because if you really had a good theory of that, you could say, well, maybe we can tweak things back here. Sort of, if you think of a lot of the talk when the government says we need to subsidize high-speed rail or we need to do this or that, underlying that argument often is, if we only diverted the way things were going, they would then go by themselves to a better outcome. And it's not clear if it's true. The classic example of this, the poster child for this theory, used to be the typewriter keyboard. Do people know the QWERTY-Dvorak story? No. Anybody heard of a Dvorak keyboard? Here is the standard story, and I'm going to tell you the story, but I'm going to warn you that none of it is true. But it was a widely believed story. And the story was that the QWERTY-OP keyboard layout, the standard keyboard layout we're all familiar with, was originally designed to slow typists down in order to prevent the keys of mechanical typewriters from jamming. That it became dominant because there was one big contest among typewriters, and the world's only touch typist at that time was using a QWERTY keyboard. And that it then stayed dominant because it was so hard to switch once it was established as the standard. The argument is that you couldn't use anything else, because if you used something else, you could only use your own typewriter because none of the rest would fit. That was the story. And then the claim is that sometime in, I guess, would have been the late 30s, a man called Dvorak designed a much, much better keyboard layout. You could learn it faster, you could type much faster, and so forth and so on. And that this was supposedly confirmed by U.S., I think, Navy tests during the war. But nonetheless, everybody kept using the QWERTY keyboard because, et cetera. That was the story. And a couple of economists, Margolis and... forget, I know them anyway, did an article called The Fable of the Keys, which actually looked into the history and showed that every fact I've told you is false. That the keyboard was not designed to slow typists. What it was actually designed to do was to alternate, what was to have letter, have the two hands alternate, so that two letters that followed each other would be on opposite sides of the keyboard in order to prevent jamming, because you had two banks of keys and it was hitting two keys of one bank that gave you the jam. That's also a pretty good rule, even when you don't worry about physical keyboards, because it means your hands are alternating. There were many different contests won by different people, lots of people who were touch typing. In the 19th century, it was quite inexpensive to switch your typewriter, because all you did is you hired somebody to re-solder the letters that were at the ends of the arms so as to get a different pattern. Many people in the 19th century only used one typewriter, because typewriters varied a good deal. So if you were, say, a reporter, you would just have your typewriter. If that's the case, if something else was much better, it would pay you to switch. And the most telling thing is that the Navy research in question was done at a time when Mr. Dvorak, who had patented the Dvorak keyboard, was working for the Navy doing research on that kind of stuff. And the people who wrote the article managed, unlike the economic historians who had told the original story, one of whom teaches at Stanford, managed to actually get a copy of the report on the Navy tests, from which it was clear that it was puffery, that it was not actually describing scientific tests. And it turned out that after the war, some companies got interested in the subject, ran their own tests, and concluded that the Dvorak keyboard was only marginally better than the QWERTY-OP keyboard. And I can add to that the fact that one of my colleagues when I was in Chicago, I think later was dean of the law school, told me that he had retrained to the Dvorak keyboard and that in fact had not found this to be a substantial improvement. So that's the sort of standard path dependency story. That's the story where people say, look, we were all worse off because the wrong standard was chosen. Initially, if only you had had some mechanism to push you to the right direction. So that's one reason why, going back to driving right, driving the left, that's sort of, again, a toy example. But having seen that example, you can think about the possibilities for path dependence. All right. Anyway, so other ideas, subgame perfect equilibrium, looks like a useful way of thinking about something like, say, a bankruptcy procedure or some other legal procedure. You have one step after another. Each step, somebody is making a decision, and you can say, well, all right, how could I untangle this complex situation? We'll ask what each person would do at the last choice he makes and go back by that. So I think I think many of these are useful in that understanding it makes you a little bit better at thinking about certain kinds of problems, but none of them really give you a rigorous answer to what are people going to do or even what are you going to do. Among the things that come out of them, as I say, one of them is the idea of commitment strategies and why they're important. Bilateral monopoly is the clearest example, and you're all familiar with it in an intuitive sense. If you think about, union management bargaining kinds of things or diplomacy between the Israelis and the Palestinians, it's pretty clear that in many such cases there's some range of outcomes that would be tolerable to both parties. Each party is trying to push it to one end of his end of the range, and one way of doing it is trying to make it hard for you to accept something at the other range, trying to make it look hard. So that's a useful concept. One of the things that comes out of that is actually relevant for legal rules is that the bigger the bargaining range, the greater the incentive to spend resources trying to push it to your end. So that if we have an apple that's worth 52 cents to you and 50 cents to me, there's not much bargaining to be done. If we have something that's worth nothing to me and $1 million to you, then you could imagine spending a lot of money on lawyers or whatever else you use to try to do the bargaining. And I think I mentioned the one legal implication of this, which is the question of injunctions versus damages. That if I am doing something which the court holds I'm not entitled to do, and the question is, should it grant the plaintiff an injunction to stop me doing it or only a damage payment from damage to do it? That if the cost to me of stopping it is much, much larger than the damages involved, that's a strong argument against an injunction because that sets up a bilateral monopoly bargaining where I'm trying to buy your permission not to shut down my factory, and you can see large resources being consumed to that. All right? So that would be an example of something relevant to the law that's useful. I find the whole sort of hawk-dove equilibrium stuff intriguing as a way of thinking about human societies, about the sense in which people have committed themselves to different life strategies, as it were, and the payoff to my strategy probably depends on what strategies everybody else is committed to. So I guess those were the things I was thinking of saying in just sort of a brief rerun of the game theory chapter. Other questions on game theory? But I do hope that all of you sort of after class will sort of run through in your head, is there something I don't really understand, and then just bring it up at the next class, because I have this sort of, I get more and more tired of the kind of class where I'm basically rewording the book for an hour and a quarter. It doesn't seem to be very productive for me or for you, since all of you know how to read. Now, besides, I probably wrote it better in the book anyway, because I could do it more carefully than when I'm speaking. So I'd rather, as much as possible, focus on the things you'd like to, that you don't understand. Or disagree with, for that matter. That's perfectly legitimate. Alright, so the next subject is value of life. And that's one that I find sort of intriguing, and it's one of the intriguing ones where I think there really are answers. And you can see why value of life matters. I discuss it, apply it mainly to tort law in that chapter, and the question there is, if I do things which result in someone else dying, what should happen? And if it's on purpose, then the answer is I go to jail for murder. But in the much more plausible case, where I didn't intend anybody to die, but I knew or should have known that there was some risk of it, what should be the penalties? And if you think about it for a while, you realize that every one of us has in fact done things which impose some risk of somebody else dying, namely driving. All right? If you drive, I mean, a few years ago, there was some point where I guess I stopped in time, but there were people walking across something and I wasn't paying very close attention, and it occurred to me afterwards I could have killed somebody. Unfortunately, I didn't, and probably that's true at some point in our life for everybody. And to some extent we're deterred by the thought of what a dreadful idea it is to kill another human being. But especially if you're thinking in terms of large organizations, another question is, what bad things will happen to me if I am so careless as to do something to kill somebody else? So, in the context of tort law, that becomes the question of damages for loss of life. But it matters elsewhere. So, if you're designing criminal law, you may not put it in those terms, but one of the things you're thinking about is, how much is it worth to cut down the number of murders? All right, we could. And there are different kinds of costs that you could say, well, we could reduce the number of murders by hiring more cops so that murderers are more likely to be caught. We could reduce the number of murders by having surveillance cameras up on poles, which we're sort of unhappy with from a privacy standpoint, but it makes it easier to catch murderers, and maybe that's a reason to do it. We could reduce the number of murderers by punishing them more severely, by keeping them in jail longer, which is costly for us and, of course, for them as well. And on the other side, you say, well, what about the death penalty? And if you're thinking about whether the death penalty is a good idea, one of the questions you'd like to know is, in some sense, taking account of everybody, how big a cost is it when somebody is killed, when someone is executed? Now, of course, if you believe that the death penalty prevents murders, you might say, well, it's the argument the other way around. We execute one person and save three victims. We feel more sympathetic to the victims anyway. It's a net gain in life. But it might be that you could say, well, yes, we could do that, but instead of executing somebody, we just keep people in jail for longer or hire more police or something else. What are the trade-offs among those? So if you're trying to sort of imagine yourself constructing a criminal legal system, one of the many questions you want to know is how much is the human life worth? And many people will say that's sort of a question you should never ask, but that's because they don't like thinking clearly, at least in my view. Similarly, in regulation, if you make, not just regulation, government decisions in general, you're designing highways. It costs more to bank the turns. Well, you can have engineers tell you banking the turn on this highway will save one life per year on average. And you would then say, well, all right, how much does it cost? Is it worth it? And again, the highway engineers are going to be very uncomfortable, some of them at least, with admitting that they decided not to bank it because it saved $1 million worth of lives at a cost of $2 million worth of construction. But at some point, you're always making that decision because you could always, you know, spend more resources making things safer, and yet, in fact, we don't. And similarly, if you think about medical matters, that you know, is it worth spending X dollars to reduce the death rate from cancer by a certain amount? And again, if you put it in that form, a lot of people will be unhappy and will say you're a heartless person who's taken too many economics courses. And yet, if you don't put it in that form, you either end up making your decisions at random, or you end up saying we should spend the entire resources of the country on things that save life at the sacrifice of everything else that makes life worth living. And that doesn't make much sense either. And finally, implicitly, you're doing it in your private decisions because you're deciding whether to buy the more expensive car that's got the better brakes or better crash resistance or whatever. You're deciding whether to get medical exams, how often, and so forth. And while you're unlikely to do it in any very sort of explicit numerical calculation, it helps to at least try thinking clearly about how much is my life worth to me, how much am I willing to spend. There was some work done by somebody who works in this field quite a long time ago, in which he looked at what the value of life was that was implicit in decisions made by governments in lots of different contexts. So if you say, all right, you're designing a highway, if you look at how much you're willing to pay to bank a curve, implicitly how much are you valuing a life at? You are also subsidizing medical care. So I don't remember what his list of things were. And you're also making regulations showing other people what to do. And his conclusion was that they were wildly inconsistent, that there were some contexts in which the government was acting as if a life was worth $20,000 and some as if it was worth $100 million. And that's, at least to the orderly mind, seems crazy. You could say, well, look, we could save more lives at lower cost if the ones where we were treating a life worth of $20,000, we started treating it like $100,000, and therefore willing to spend a little more to save lives, and the ones where we're treating it at $100 million, we take it down to $10 million, and thus save money at a very small cost in life. That makes sense. So again, it is worth thinking clearly about these things. I would argue, and he was arguing, and Kip Viscusi is the person whose work I'm quoting, if I remember correctly. Anyway, so those are reasons why I think it's worth trying to think about it. And as I say, one of the things I like about this particular chapter is that I actually get somewhere. That is, I think I actually, when I finished, it was originally an article, not a chapter, but when I finished it, I understood more about the problem than when I started, and that is not always the case. So we start with a very simple puzzle. which is how much is a life worth? And the puzzle is that we have two entirely different answers. All right, so how much is your life worth?
$3 million.
So if I can offer you $3 million for your heart, well, I happen to need a heart transplant, will you sell it? Why not?
Because I need it right now.
You need a heart, but then your life is worth more than $3 million?
Where is it?
Yep.
Stocks, money's worthless when you're dead.
That's right. That was the sort of first critical insight, which is sort of obvious after you say it, but I think not obvious before it, that the reason you're getting these two different answers, one of them the answer you get from asking how much are you willing to spend to slightly reduce the chance of dying, be in the more expensive car or whatever, versus what price will you accept for your heart, that the difference is not the value of life, but the value of the dollars. That in the price for your heart, you're being paid with dollars that are probably worth nothing to you because you're not going to be alive to spend them, unless... And we then think of the exception. Who are the people who do sell their life? The people who have some very important objective, such as my country winning the war, which doesn't require them to be alive to achieve. And there are people who do that. The guy who jumps on the grenade, where probably the objective is not even my country winning the war, it's my buddy's not getting killed. Better one of me than five of them. So that is something which makes sense out of the apparently inconsistent behavior. That we have a value for our life, and measured in, as it were, constant dollars, it's consistent. It's just that one of our hypothetical experiments is measuring in dollars of very low value and the other in dollars of ordinary value. And if you then ask which is the right value, if you imagine that you're making rules for tort law or regulations or whatever, I think the answer pretty clearly is that it's the probabilistic one, not the certain one, because if we spend money banking a highway, that money is being taken from living people who will otherwise spend those dollars on whatever things people ordinarily spend their money on. It's not being taken from dead people. That makes sense. So therefore, if you have to pick a value of the dollar, it ought to be the value of the dollar to ordinary people under ordinary circumstances, because that's the kind of dollars that are being given up when people make choices that affect the chance of killing other people. All right, is that logic of that work all right? Yes? So if that's right, then that says that just to answer this question with regard to regulation, with regard to tort law, with regard to criminal law, the right thing to do is to try to figure out how much somebody's life is worth when he's making choices and have a small chance of affecting his it'll have a small effect on his life expectancy, because those are situations in which he expects the money that he gets to be money he actually spends. So that's really using ordinary body value dollars. And in a way, this sort of points us back at the discussion back when we were discussing economic efficiency, that one of the problems with economic efficiency as a criterion is that it assumes a dollar is worth the same amount to everybody. And this is just a case where that problem really bites you badly because it's such a strikingly different values of dollars. All right, so that sort of is the first step in the argument, which I at least want to make. Now, one next question that might occur to you, which is less interesting to me because I'm basically a theorist, not an experimentalist, but the question is how would you find out what it was? And various people, like this Guzzi is somebody who's written on that subject, and you can look at decisions people make. It's hard to do really controlled experiments with human beings so that you can say, well, here are two professions that look very similar, except one of them is much more dangerous than the other. How much more do you have to pay people to work in the more dangerous one? But as I mentioned in the book, that's imperfect because they aren't the same people. That the people who choose to take the dangerous profession will tend to be those who have a lower value for their life than average. And also, they may be ones who like excitement. I mentioned in the book Snow Crash. Have you done Snow Crash this class? I discussed with one of my classes, but they have been done. Any of you read Snow Crash?
No.
That's right. Snow Crash is this sort of tongue-in-cheek near-future science fiction novel, which I thought was quite a lot of fun. And at the very beginning, the protagonist's name, by the way, is Hero Protagonist, though spelled differently. And the protagonist is delivering pizza for the mafia. The mafia has come to dominate pizza delivery. And the mafia has its own approach to pizza delivery.
that when the pizza comes out of the oven, a little LED timer on the pizza is turned on. And it's more than, I think, either 30 minutes or 20 minutes when the pizza reaches the customer. The head of the mafia comes to apologize to the customer. They are guaranteeing 20 minutes for 30 minutes. The head of the mafia really doesn't like having to apologize to customers. And that makes pizza delivery a really high-tension job with high tech and all sorts of things, and a sort of implication that if you come in late more than once or twice, you may be finished, permanently finished. So anyway, part of the point, of course, of that particular bit of the book, other stuff in it, is that there are some people for whom that's an asset, not a liability. So the protagonist wouldn't be delivering pizza if it weren't that the mafia was in charge of pizza delivery in this fashion. And it just sort of struck me as a nice encapsulation of that particular problem with measuring value. But actually, if you want some light reading, I'd love there is one of the other characters in the book is a guy who drives. I should say this is a pretty much anarchist future. There still is a U.S. government that doesn't control anything anymore. It's sort of pure symbolic. And there's a guy who is, I think, a Native American from like Alaska or the equivalent, who drives around in a motorcycle with a sidecar, and he has poor impulse control tattooed on his forehead, and everybody is very careful with him because they know that what's in the sidecar is a nuclear warhead that he got off of a Russian submarine or something, and when he dies, it goes off. Anyway, lots of fun things. But it makes that particular point quite well. But also, as I say, you can also look at what premiums people pay for safer cars, for medical checkups when they're paying for them themselves, and so forth. And I gather, at least when I last knew the literature, that you're talking about a range of about $1 million to $10 million. It's a sort of range of what random Americans have valued their life out on that evidence. And we then get to tort law. And the traditional common law rule was that if you were tortuously killed, your claim died with you. And therefore, I tortuously kill you. Too bad. And in the course of the 19th century, various states passed what were called survivor statutes, which basically said that your dependents could sue for the loss to them if you're dying. And to an economist, that seems obviously wrong, because if you have no dependents, that doesn't mean your life is of no value. It's all still a value to you. And we would like to deter people from risking their lives, even if those are nobody else depends on. And one of the reasons this interests me is that it's probably the best example I know of evidence against the Posner thesis. Because the Posner thesis is that the common law tends to be economically efficient. It is very hard to believe that it could be economically efficient to have no tort damages at all for a tort that does $1 million worth of damage. And yet that's what the common law did. And insofar as it's not entirely true now, it's not common law, but it's statutory law, which is what Posner does not claim is efficient. And that's one reason which makes it interesting to law and economic people, at least. But it's also of interest if you're trying to figure out what the legal system ought to be, to think about damages for loss of life. And then the implication of the arguments I'm making is that you ought to have damages that reflect some estimate of the actual value of the person's life to itself, as well as whatever it's worth to other people. And the term for this idea in general is what's referred to as hedonic damages. Hedonism, as you may know, is the philosophy that says you should maximize pleasure in your life. And hedonic damages means thinking of the utility people get from whatever as a real value, which it surely is, and thus saying that not only should you base damages for loss of life on what somebody's life was worth to him, but if you cripple somebody, you should somehow try to base the damages on some measure of how much worse off he is for being crippled, not just if it's not the loss of himself. And as far as I know, no state in the country actually follows that rule, but it's something that some people have argued, I think, plausibly enough for. That then gets me into the sort of other puzzling way which is connected with the first puzzle, which I think is answered by the first puzzle, and that's that the normal rule for tort damages, the sort of black letter rule, is supposed to be to make the victim good, make the victim whole. And that seems impossible if you kill somebody. But it's more interesting, I think, from that standpoint. You can see the problem more clearly if you think of injury short death. So if what you did tortiously was to blind somebody, what does it mean to make it whole? And the economist's answer would be to give him enough money so that he doesn't care whether he is blinded and has that amount of money or is left with his sight and doesn't get that amount of money. That would be a reasonable economic definition of indifference, so you make it whole. And that seems like a mistake. Not a mistake of logic, but a mistake in terms of not what you really want the legal system to do. And the reason is that doing that transfers money to somebody who doesn't have much use for the money. And the reason it does that is not that he has no use for money at all, but that after you've given him enough money to make up his loss of income, to pay his medical costs, to pay for the seeing eye dog, to do everything you can compensate, he is still worse off than what he could see. At least I try to imagine being blind, at least that would be. So if you're going to make him whole, you're going to have to keep giving him more and more money in order that he can substitute with pleasures that he still can enjoy, gourmet food, say, for the pleasures he no longer can enjoy because he can no longer see or walk or whatever you imagine the injury to be. And that means that you're pushing out his utility function, as it were, to the point where marginal utility becomes very low. Does that make sense logically?
Yes, no.
A different way of putting it, and this is a point which is going to recur again at other points in the semester, is that you can think of tort damages as serving two different functions. One of them is deterrence, which in our terms you would think of as a Pigouvian tax, a way of making people who might impose injuries on others take account of them, and the other is insurance. So why do people like the idea of tort damages? One reason is to say, because you're going to really need the money after you've been injured or had your house destroyed or your car smashed, so we're going to make it up for you, so it's like a form of insurance. And the other is deterrence. The other is the idea of saying we want other people to take account of the cost. And there is a set of cases for which it seems as though the right value for those two purposes. Imagine a tort which is doing purely monetary damage. All right, the tort is destroying your house or your car, and you can buy another house or car just like it at a price. Well, how much insurance would you like against that event? And the answer is, if we're assuming that you have no responsibility, we don't have to worry about moral hazard and about effect on your incentives, you would then like 100% insurance, right? Because of risk aversion. So the right amount of insurance in that case is the full amount of the damage. What's the right Pigouvian tax? The full amount of the damage. That way you'll fully get paralyzed. So if you're thinking, if your metaphor is of monetary damages, you don't worry much about separating the insurance function from the deterrence function. They both give the same answer. And that answer is the black letter law, namely make the victim whole. Once you get out of that area, though, there's no logical reason why the optimal amount of insurance and the optimal deterrence are the same, and the clear case for that is death. Because you can easily imagine somebody who would choose to carry no life insurance at all because he has no dependents. He can't spend the money once he's dead. So his optimal life insurance is zero, and yet his life is still valuable to him, and therefore the optimal penalty, the Pigouvian tax, effluent be, whatever you want to call it, for somebody whose actions cause him to die is much more than zero.
Logic makes sense?
Yes,
no.
So, if that's right, then in any case like that, the intuition that tort damages give the right answer to both questions is wrong. And you then end up that there is one optimal level of insurance, there is one optimal level of deterrence, and never the twain shall meet, or at least there's no reason.
Right.
I still can't tell whether I'm wasting my time because it's all obvious or wasting my time because none of it makes any sense to you or somewhere in between. There's an inadequate feedback in this thing. Have I described to you my technological idea for solving this problem?
Yes.
It could actually be done pretty easily now. It's what I think of as a silent student problem, which is that you're going on at great length about something you understand perfectly well if you've taught this course 700 times before. And at some point you say, did everybody follow that? And no one says anything. And you say, obviously they all follow it, you keep going. And only when you grade the midterm do you discover your mistake. And of course what's going on is that nobody, almost nobody followed it. But each person said, well, maybe the others follow it, and I'm going to look really stupid if I say that I didn't. And therefore no one speaks. So it's an externality problem. You would provide an external benefit to all the students, to the professor, that you didn't understand his explanation, and he has to go over it again more carefully, but you don't. So my solution is that you set up a classroom where in every place there's a button under the student's foot, which can be unobtrusively pushed. And at the back of the classroom, there is a screen that shows how many buttons are being pushed. And so I say, well, everybody who followed my clear and lucid explanation of this point, please press this button. And there's a classroom with 80 people in it, and the number 3 appears on the screen at the back, and I know I have to go back. So that's an attempt to apply economics to the job of teaching economics. And it could be done now. There are now wireless devices that actually are used for in-class feedback. But I must admit that although I thought it was a very clever, clever idea, I have not been so ambitious as to try to actually do it. All right, let's... So what's the solution to this problem? How would we go about getting both optimal deterrence and optimal insurance given that the numbers are different? How would we use the tort system for the person who doesn't want life insurance? The person who has no family, nobody dependent on him. Yep.
He sells his...
That's right. You,
to someone else, right?
That's right. What you want to do is have a legal regime where you can sell his non-potential claim, his inchoate claim, to anybody who will buy it. And now he gets to enjoy the doc. And notice that now we really are making him whole next update. Because he's getting the money, not the $1 million damage payment, but the $100 that represents the average damage payment given that he's very unlikely to be killed. He gets to spend that when he's alive and well. So he's fully compensated ex ante for the risk being imposed on him, although, of course, if he actually gets killed, that will be a net loss to him, but he doesn't think that was a game. And so to let that happen, you need a legal regime which people can sell inchoate towards, which I don't believe, as far as I know, there's no way of doing at the moment. So in that regime, you can do both. The legal system has to set the damage payment for loss of life. And you can't do it very well because people vary a lot. We don't have any good way of knowing exactly, but you can say, you know, $3 million a head or something like that, some plausible estimate. And then let the market set the amount of insurance each person wants by letting him either sell his claim, or if he really feels that his family needs more than $3 million, he can buy additional life insurance. And I will be arguing later that making inchoate tort claims marketable is actually useful for a bunch of reasons. Think about the problem of class actions. Is there anybody here who regards class actions as an entirely satisfactory solution to the problem they're supposed to solve? The problem is, what if I commit a tort that imposes not very large injuries on very large injuries? And in the sort of standard tort context, nothing happens because each individual says, what's the point of suing for $8? And class action is supposed to solve that problem because it's worth suing for $8 million and there are a million individuals at $8 each. What's the problem with class action if they now exist? Lawyer gets all the money. The lawyer gets all the money and the lawyer has an incentive to sacrifice the interest of the class to his interest. Right? From the standpoint of the lawyer, as far as I can tell, as a very casual observer, the standard outcome of one of these suits is $10 million, $1 million to the lawyer, and $9 million in the form of coupons that we will distribute to our customers, allowing them to buy our next product for 10% off. That's really a $1 million payment all to the lawyer, in effect. my claim is that if you allow inchoate torts to be marketed, we have a better solution. Because under those institutions, you will have middlemen who will buy up very, very large quantities of potential claims. So your insurance company or your employer or some large organization that has contractual involvement with millions of people says to them, look, we'll give you $20 off on your insurance premium if you agree to transfer to us any claims that eventuate that you tort claims you have for less than $100. You know you're never going to sue on those things yourself anyways. You're getting something for it. So now you've got a bunch of middlemen, each of whom owns a few million such claims. And of course their claim is not a tort claim for a particular tort. It's all small tort claims against a million people. So now some enterprising entrepreneurial lawyer finds evidence that asbestos causes lung cancer, whatever it is, and instead of doing a class action, he goes to these middlemen and says, I would like to buy from you. Not all of what you have. All I want to buy are the asbestos claims for those million people. And once he's bought up the asbestos claims for 14 or 15 million people, he now sues on his own behalf. He now has an incentive to try to get real money out of people because he's getting the money, all of it. But of course, the people who are the real victim get the money in advance in whatever payment they got for the provision. So my claim, at least, is that marketable inchoate torts would actually represent a mechanism better than class actions for solving this kind of problems. And as I may or may not have mentioned, I like to claim that this is the evidence that our legal system is that we're 1,000 years behind the cutting edge of legal technology, because I don't know actually of any society that had inchoate torts marketable, but at least Iceland 1,000 years ago had tort claims marketable, which we don't. So anyway, that's a different part of the same pattern I'm discussing in this chapter here, which is that you can optimize. Oh, yep.
I guess my question is, it does seem like the proper thing would be to have a code for marketable.
Yep.
How come the legal system does?
I don't know. That is, in a sense, this goes back to the question of whether Posner is right. That if you believe that common law has an innate tendency to economic efficiency, and if I'm right about the desirability of these institutions, then you would get it. And so then there are three possible explanations. One is I'm wrong, that there are reasons why it's a bad idea that I haven't thought of. One is, go back for a moment, forget about this room, just go back to economic damages. Somebody might plausibly argue, well, yes, in theory, with perfectly wise courts, economic damages are the way to go. But given real courts and the possible abilities of inflammatory rhetoric and such, we really want ways of making sure that there's some punishment for this thing. We don't want it as big as it theoretically should be, because then we'll have lots of money going to lawyers and lots of uncertainty. But that's a plausible argument. going back to the inquiry, one possibility is I'm wrong. One possibility is Posner is wrong, that we don't actually have mechanisms that generate efficient law. And that's one of the questions sort of running through my book, which we end up discussing some at the very end of the book, of whether Posner is right that common law is efficient. We don't have mechanisms to generate efficient legislative law. Sort of in a sense, the standard economist's evidence for that is tariffs. That the economics of tariffs, the economics of foreign trade, were correctly worked out just a little less than 200 years ago by a man called David Ricardo, one of the founders of economics. One of the implications of his analysis is that with certain very special case exceptions, a country that imposes tariffs is shooting itself in the foot. That the tariff makes the inhabitants of that country worse off. From then till now, I can only think of two polities, one of which not independent, which acted on that case. England in the 19th century, after the repeal of the Corn Laws, which was, I think, about 1840 or so, had free trade, and Hong Kong in the second half of the 20th century had free trade. They were both spectacularly successful economies. I mean, I don't know if you followed it. Hong Kong, as of the period just after World War II, was a dirt poor society whose population density per square mile was about 10 times that of the most densely populated country in the world, and which imported drinking water. Within about 40 years or 50 years of that, the average of the per capita income of Hong Kong passed that of England. A very successful society. Nonetheless, almost no countries do it. And that's pretty strong evidence against the belief, at least for economists who accept Ricardo's analysis, against the belief that legislative institutions tend to give you things. And then you like to have good theories of what they do, and there's an area of economics called public choice theory, which at least tries to apply economics to understanding, among other things, why we have tariffs. There's a straightforward explanation of why we have tariffs. And the general, which really comes out of stuff we've already done, and that is, if you think about interest groups trying to get legislation, the more concentrated an interest group, favorable legislation for an interest group is a public good for the group, not for the whole society. So that if I am a steel firm, if the other steel firms lobby Congress to get a tariff against foreign steel, I'll benefit. So from the standpoint of the group of steel firms, tariffs against steel are a public good. If I get a tariff against steel, that will hurt various other Americans, consumers of steel, and less obviously producers of export goods, because if foreigners sell us less steel, they'll have fewer dollars from which to buy our wheat. So we have two interest groups competing with each other to buy votes in Congress. One of them consists of a couple of dozen firms, and the other consists of about 300 million individuals. The smaller an interest group is, and the better organized it is, the easier it can solve its own public good problem. So if you imagine a public good which benefits four people, it's not very hard for the four people to gather together and say, look, I'll chip in if you'll chip in. Make it 4,000 people, and it's very, very hard. So one of the predictions of public choice theory is that governments will tend to benefit concentrated and organized interest groups at the expense of dispersed and disorganized interest groups. Does that make sense? Tariffs benefit producers, which is usually a small number of firms, at the cost of consumers, which are usually a large number. And therefore, the economics of politics predicts tariffs will happen, whereas the application of economics to what the law should be says they won't. So that's sort of an example. But anyway, so we've got three answers. The answer I prefer, of course, is I'm right, Posner is wrong, and the law is inefficient, but I could be wrong.
Wouldn't the market for inchoate tort claims require a near omniscient actuary to be able to put a value on?
Why is that any different than the current market for insurance?
Well, I mean, for like life insurance, you know you're going to eventually die. I mean, it's
well, we don't know when, then when.
We don't know when, but there's certain, it's sort of a trajectory. There might be different, you know.
But we also, what we insure is that we don't know that your house is going to burn down. We have fire insurance, even though very few houses burn down. That's going to mean they're all the same problem then. Which now you have to have an omniscient actuary. You have to have an actuary good enough so you're willing to bet on their estimates.
But I also know that in some states, at least, you can. There are markets for selling the life insurance policies. My dad worked for a company to buy life insurance back from people and give them a smaller chunk of money than it was worth.
Yep. But that's the insurance policy, not the smart plan.
Exactly.
Yep. No, insurance policy is our market.
But it looks like the framework is slowly being built.
Going back to torts, what's the third function of tort? Because I want to argue that part of what makes it hard to design sort of a good legal system is this particular tool is serving three different functions. So one of the things that tort damages are is a form of insurance. And I would argue it's a rather poor form of insurance because I really want to be insured against dying, not against dying due to somebody else's negligence, since most causes of dying aren't due to people's negligence. So it's a very fragmentary insurance. A second thing it is a Pigouvian tax on people, on tort feasors. What's the third function of this? Who is affected by the amount of damages other than the victim via insurance and the potential tort feasor via insurance? The lawyer, that's right. Correct. The answer is the obvious, all of you people, you're in the end. That is, putting it differently, the tort system can also be viewed as a bounty system. All right? One way of catching murderers is to say, bring in a murderer, dead or alive, $1,000. One way of catching tortfeasors is to say, sue a tortfeasor, win the case, $1,000. So that you can think of the damage payment as being simultaneously the punishment for committing a tort, the insurance for the victim, and the bounty to the victim or his lawyer, whoever it is who manages to prove the case. Alright? Make sense? And I'm interested in that way of thinking it, but one of the things we'll be discussing with you later in the semester is whether you would convert criminal law into tort law. One of the weird features of all modern legal systems that I'm familiar with is that they're redundant, that they've got two systems of rules thought of as independent that are really doing the same work. All right? What is criminal law doing? It's giving people a reason not to do bad things to other people by punishing them for doing it. What is tort law doing? It's giving people a reason not to do bad things to other people by punishing them for doing it. And it's a point that's been easier to make since O.J. Simpson was first acquitted of the crime of killing his wife and then convicted of the tort thing. And so one question is, why is there any good reason to have this double system? And one of the ways of putting that is could you run a functional modern legal system which was pure tort and no crime, in which when you killed somebody, somebody sued you. And as this discussion here suggests, it wouldn't have to be the dead guy suing you. It's hard to sue people when you're dead. But you can easily enough imagine along the lines we're discussing that one of the things you sell people is the right to collect your murder judgment, so to speak. You have to be killed. And then as long as there's somebody who collects it, he's got an incentive to prove who killed you and collect the damages and so forth. So we have a chapter on what I think of as the crime tort puzzle, where one of the questions I try to discuss is, could you have a functioning legal system? A related question, which I don't discuss there, but it's worth thinking about, is could you have a functioning legal system with pure crime? In which, when you break a contract, the other guy doesn't sue you, he calls the police and says, I'd like to report Mr. Smith for the crime of breaking his contract. As it happens, I have historical examples of both. I have a pure tort system that lasted for about a third of a millennium, and I've got a pure crime system that lasted for about two millennia. Tort one is Saga period Iceland, and the crime one is Imperial China. And this is stuff that I cover in my legal system for a different seminar, which is fun.
I might be completely off tangent here, but didn't the Greeks have a pure tort system?
Or almost a pure tort system? Not exactly. I only know Athenian law, but the pattern in Athenian law is that you have two categories of offenses. The ones that correspond to our torts can only be prosecuted by the victim or his representative. The ones that correspond to our crimes can be prosecuted by any adult male Athenian citizen. So it's private in that sense, but it isn't the case that the victim has to claim. And the ones that correspond to our crimes, the result of a successful prosecution for most of them, is that the defendant pays a large fine, a substantial fraction of which goes to the prosecutor. So it really is something between a criminal and so that's a very interesting system. And one of the interesting features of that is that it occurred to them that this is creating an incentive for going after people who have deep pockets, whether they've done anything wrong or not. And they have solutions to that problem. Because they had very big juries. They had juries of a couple of hundred people. Among other things, I think the Athenian jury system was probably a welfare system. It was probably that you couldn't support yourself any other way, you could volunteer to be a juror.
For old men.
What?
It was for old men, that was the joke.
Yep.
Aristophanes is all the drop my day thing.
That's right. And so one of the rules was that if the prosecutor failed to get a certain number, I think it was 30%. Not sure, the jurors to vote for conviction, the prosecutor was fine.
And I thought that would be kind of a fun one to think about in an artistic view. I had, say, tort law. Suppose we said that in tort law, if you couldn't get four jurors to vote for in favor of the plaintiff owed a damages to the defendant for wasting his time for harassing. I don't know if it's a good idea or not, but it's sort of a fun idea. Athenian, I don't know how much you know about Athenian law, but it really has the feel of a bunch of very smart intellectuals picking up clever ideas, some of which work and some of which don't. There's one part of it which I like this described as invented by a man economist. Do you know how they handled the problem of funding public goods in Athens?
Yeah, they had they would throw somebody out of the country every 10 years or something?
That's a different system.
Oh, okay.
No, this one, I'm trying to remember the name, it has a name which is a modern English word with a different but they have a system in which the richest Athenians are required to fund to pay for one public good every 2 years. So the relevant magistrate comes to you and he says, as you may know, we're planning to send a team to the Olympics this year. Congratulations, you're the sponsor. And, or, you see that lovely trireme down at the deck? Guess who's paying for her this year? And there are two ways of getting out of it. One of them is to show that you've already done one of these things this year, or did one last year, because every other year. And the other is to show that there is another Athenian who isn't doing one this year, didn't do one last year, and is richer than you are. And therefore, he should do it instead of you. So the question is, how in ancient Athens, with no accountants, and no bank accounts, and no IRS, how do I prove the original than I am? That's the economist's answer. Want to propose a solution to this problem?
Would you offer to exchange wealth with them?
That's right. You know the answer. That's right. You offer to trade everything you own with everything he owns. And if he turns you down, he can finish your trade. Isn't that beautiful? I'm not sure it works, but it's beautiful. As you may know, there's a related, analogous approach that people occasionally suggested for, in effect, combining property taxes with a solution to the eminent domain problem. The eminent domain problem, that is the argument for having eminent domain. You all know what eminent domain is. Allowing various government units to seize property, which they have to pay for, but not at a price that the seller is willing to sell at. And the argument for it is sort of hold up problem. The argument is, how can we build a highway when somebody who realizes that he's right in the line of the highway can charge us the sky for his property? So the proposal that somebody came up with is that you have a self-assessed property tax, that each property owner sets whatever price he likes, whatever value he likes in his property. He is taxed on the basis of that property, but he is legally required to sell to any buyer at that price. So now, we don't need eminent domain. People are not going to take their $10,000 piece of property and claim it's worth $10 million because then they'll be paying property tax at the rate for $10 million. And so if we decide we need to put together a bunch of parcels, there are the prices sitting out there that people are required to sell. So a lot of people dislike the idea, partly because they've got the picture of, I've got this home, I've lived in it all my life, it's an immense value to me, but why do I have to pay a big premium because I like it so much? But nonetheless, it's got the same feel as it is that Athenian system of sort of getting, of leveraging rational self-interest to do things. I think where there are other features of Athenian law that we just have to be talking about that are particularly fun. But it was very, very much an interesting system. All right, so let me go back for a moment to the crippling injury, where I think the answers they are in the book, indeed, that's sort of obvious from what we've said. But that, again, the argument is that you want to separate the damage payment, that you want to separate the Pigouvian tax from the insurance, and the way you do it is to set a Pigouvian tax, which represents the real value of the person of the injury, the real cost of the injury, and then let people buy or sell insurance. and what's the real cost of the injury, just as in the more extreme case of death, we want to evaluate dollars at their normal value, not at the very, very low value they have if you are both blind and rich. If you imagine the problem, it doesn't come from being blind. It comes from your being blind, then being fully compensated for the monetary cost of being blind, and then having the additional compensation that we needed to make up for the non-monetary costs, as it were. And by that time, a dollar is worth hardly anything to you. Maybe. I don't know if you really like gourmet meals and don't like looking at things very much, but think of the normal case, I think it would be. And so we don't want to compensate you at that rate. So what do? We compensate you at the same rate that would correspond to what you would pay to reduce the risk of being blind. All right, we're crippled in whatever the risk is. So at that rate, which is presumably less than the value of your life, because after all, you can always kill yourself after you're blind, and so it can't be more than that. At least that's what economists would say. I don't know if it's fair or not, but it's the economist's natural reaction to such a situation. Then if we do it at that level, that's your compensation, and that's almost certainly going to be more than the amount, it's going to be at least the amount that it's going to take to pay all the financial costs, to make up your lost salary, to pay for your guide dog, and so forth. May or may not be, it would be more than that, because at that point, you would, even in ordinary dollars, as it were, you would still be worse off. So it would be something more than that, but not billions more than that. And then you have the choice, if you wish, of saying, well, at that amount, marginal utility to even a dollar is low, so I'm going to sell 10% of my hypothetical damage payment to somebody else to enjoy the money when I can still see it. So it's really the same solution that you would get out in that case. Let's see. What else of interest? Let me mention, let me go back for a moment to my pure crime system. Because that's not in the book, because I didn't know about it when I wrote that book. I discovered it later. But as far as I can tell, in Imperial China, there is nothing corresponding to our civil law. And the particular case that I know something about has to do with contract law. Because about 1900, China ceded Taiwan to Japan. And the Japanese decided that instead of trying to impose Japanese law on Taiwan, they would just enforce the existing Chinese law. And what's the first thing you have to do if you want to enforce the existing Chinese law? Yes, right, what it is, right. So there was this large scholarly project by a bunch of Japanese scholars doing research in the existing legal system on Taiwan. And it produced a lot of volumes of research, and modern people have mined those volumes, and there's an interesting book chapter that I use in one of my other courses on contract law. And the answer is there essentially wasn't contract law. That if you lent money to somebody you didn't pay you back, your recourse was to go to the district magistrate and accuse him of being a swindler. Criminal offense. The district magistrate could say, well, I'm busy. Go away. The district magistrate says, that's a problem. If he'll pay you half the money back, I'll forget about it. Or he could say, we don't care if he pays you the money back. We don't like swindlers. We're going to have to punish you. So it's a pure criminal, as far as I can tell. Again, I'm not an expert on Chinese law, but as far as I can tell from the stuff I read, it was a pure criminal system. And what made it fun was that the lack of contract law was combined with very elaborate and sophisticated contractual practice. So that, in fact, I think I may give you my article on that later when we're talking about contract law. But basically, it was a society where the courts were not enforcing contract law, and yet various private arrangements succeeded in letting people have contractual practice on the order of modern well, it was pretty much 1900, so it's not that long ago. And that really is quite interesting. We'll get to that. I think we'll get to that later. But that sort of struck me, because I'd come across the Icelandic case a long time ago and thought that was fun, sort of a society in which when you kill somebody's relative sued you, and then discovering that there was another one where when you swindled somebody, all they could do was to charge you with a crime. I should say the Icelandic case, since I think I've finished talking about what we're actually reading for this time, so I might as well talk about something. The Icelandic case turns out to be, in a sense, even more extreme than calling it pure tort, because it was pure tort in a society with no executive arm of government. So it is pure tort in a society in which after you got your tort judgment, it was up to you to enforce it. And the way the system works, there was law. There was a legislature. There was a court system. You get a court judgment. And the court judgment says that he violated your rights and he owes you 50 ounces or something. And he either pays or he doesn't. If he doesn't pay, you go back to the court and the court declares him an outlaw because he hasn't paid his damages. It is legal to kill an outlaw. It is tortious to defend an outlaw. He has, I think, 2 weeks to leave ISIS, after which you can kill him. So it's a pure privately enforced legal system. It's not a pure anarchy because, as I said, they did have a single legal system and a single court system. But the enforcement was right.
I know we don't have precise figures, but really, roughly, what was the population of Iceland?
70,000.
Okay,
50,000, 70,000, something in that range. And it varies, of course, over time. So it was not a very large population. It was a rather dispersed population. On the other hand, we have the sagas. The sagas were written towards the end of that period or just after the end of that period. It was about a 330-year period that had this set of institutions. And they tend to be very realistic sort of novels, historical novels and histories, basically. And judging by them, there was lots of legal activity. People did indeed sue each other, and they did have feuds, and they did sometimes kill people. And the impression you get reading the sagas is that most of the time, by the time everything was over, indeed the guy who was leading the right had won. That there's a bit in one of the most famous sagas, the Al Saga, which to me illustrates the essential stability of the system. And this, there's a big law case going on. And somebody on one side of the case goes to a benevolent neutral, to someone who's there, who's sort of friendly but isn't involved in the dispute. And he says, if it comes to violence, if we end up actually, you know, pulling our swords and axes and going, having out at each other, this is an open-air courthouse, essentially, in the middle of the trial, what will you do to help us? And he said, I'll tell you what. I'll have my people drawn up armed over there. And if you're losing, you can retreat behind them, and that'll prevent you from getting killed. And if you're winning, we'll intervene and stop the fight before you've killed more men than you can afford. That's the neat line. The assumption that even when things are breaking down this badly, eventually you kill someone, you're going to have to pay a fine to his relatives for killing him. That's very expensive. So you can afford, you know, to kill one or two people, but it gets very, very expensive very rapidly. And that limits the violence of the system. So anyway, I find that intriguing. And one of the sort of bits of data we have is that in the year 1000, Iceland went from pagan to Christian. There were a series of conflicts and a few killings leading up to that, with a Christian minority that was pretty aggressive, a pagan majority that was less aggressive, and Norway, which is what Iceland had largely been settled from, had gone Christian, was trying to pressurize the Icelanders, who were doing things like seizing Icelandic ships at Norwegian ports and saying, you can't leave unless you convert. And eventually they had an arbitrated decision, and it was decided that Iceland would become Christian with toleration for private but not public pagan worship. In the course of this dispute, maybe 8 or 9 people are killed. That kind of number. Maybe 500 years later, 600 years later, Iceland is now the possession of one of the Scandinavian monarchies, so it's whatever was the standard arrangements as of that time for European monarchies. The same thing happens again, like this time I think it's Lutheranism, changing from Catholic to Lutheran. Smaller population and about 50 people get killed. So, you know, it's a very small sample, but it does suggest that what seems to us like a very sort of violent way of handling things actually worked out better than the more conventional and more centralized way. But I'm prejudiced. Like, I like the Icelanders. It was a neat society. I enjoyed the sagas. And so forth. But anyway, going back to the tort, the subject we'll come back to much later, the sort of tort crime puzzle. The one question is, can you have a functional system which is all one or all the other? Another question is, are there advantages to having both? Another question is, if you have both, is there a good reason why we treat certain things as torts and certain things as crimes? And as you can see in the OJ case, sometimes the same thing can be either, not always. And finally, is there a good reason why we have different legal rules associated with the two systems? good reason why tort has preponderance of the evidence and criminal has beyond a reasonable doubt. Why tort does not require intent and criminal theoretically does require intent. So there are a bunch of differences that you probably know better than I do between tort law and criminal law. Is there a reason for that? Is there some logic for that? And that's a set of questions that I think most people who look at law never think to ask. That strike me as really quite interesting questions. And so I spend a chapter exploring them. I don't think I get final answers in the sense that I think I show how you could modify tort law to handle most of the problems using it to handle criminal law, perhaps not all of them. And I show why some of the differences between tort law and criminal law might make sense, but not necessarily all sort of leave it to so many side of the professors. Let me suggest that as a large research project which still remains to be done and which would benefit by much more historical research than I've done. I happen to have come across these cases, but it would be nice to look at legal systems around the world and throughout the last few thousand years, which various parts of which look like toward criminal and see what problems arise, how. All right. So, see you all next week.